Thanks for staying tuned here on KVLF in Alpine, Texas. This is Bruce Shuley with Organic Matters. I'm here almost all Saturday mornings. I'm here every Saturday, either on a recording or live. So please tune me in and tell your friends about me. It's about organic living, organic gardening. And in spite of ourselves now, we need to talk about climate change and weather patterns that have gotten more exciting than ever. So do stay tuned and invite your friends to listen along. And now let's get on with more of Organic Matters. USDA to ban downer beef. I didn't know we hadn't banned downer beef. Agriculture Secretary Ed Schaefer said yesterday that his department wants to ban all downer cattle from the slaughterhouse to boost public confidence in the safety of the nation's food supply. The proposal, which could take effect within a few months, follows the largest beef recall in the United States history earlier this year, which was the result of secretly recorded videotape that showed California meat plant workers using forklifts and electric prods on animals unable to stand in an effort to get them into the slaughterhouse. Illegal, folks. Not supposed to do that. No longer a slim possibility of transporting a cow to a market that is too weak to rise or to walk on its own. This action sends a clear message to consumers in both domestic and international markets that we will continue to uphold the highest standards to protect our food supply and deliver the highest quality products. Schaefer also said that by reducing the incentive to send weak and marginal cattle to the slaughter, it will reduce the likelihood that those animals will be subjected to inhumane handling at processing plants. Under current regulations, cows that cannot walk or stand on their own are supposed to be kept out of the food supply, in part because they may be infected with bovine spongiform encephalopathy. BSE, folks, mad cow disease. An exception allows a government veterinarian to approve for slaughter an animal that has passed initial inspection but went down before reaching the knockbox. If a second inspection determines the animal is not sick but is suffering from an acute injury such as a broken leg, the USDA plans to propose a rule that would end the exception. An exception allows government veterinarian to approve for slaughter an animal that passed initial inspection but then went on before reaching the knockbox. If a second inspection determines that animal is suffering from an acute injury or broken leg, they plan to make that an exception. Most of us have tried sunflower seeds to eat, but it is likely no longer alive. The ones that we were probably already shelled, dried, roasted, irradiated, salted, preserved, bagged, shipped, and stored, by which point every last enzyme has perished. Wouldn't it make sense to consume living seeds? Real seeds will lay dormant for many years or until activated. After sprouting, most edible seeds such as alfalfa, broccoli, and radish are left in the sun for a couple of days so they can get some chlorophyll flowing. After learning to grow sprouts, you may try growing sunflower greens. Whole sunflowers or other vegetables, it's important to understand the main types of seeds. Heirloom seeds, also called heritage seeds, will reproduce the same every time, every generation. Most of us assume all seeds like this, but they're not. Hybrid seeds are the product of two unique plants, and the seeds will gradually revert to the dominant parent over subsequent generations. While providing more variety, these seeds must be purchased again each season to obtain the same crop. Wed that GMO crops have 10% lower yields. Genetically modified is not better, it's worse, folks. They actually have lower yields, and you're forced to buy genetically modified seeds. Probably not a very good idea to me. Not a good idea at all. As a matter of fact, here's what Monsanto is doing to fix that. They've learned what they call make Terminator seeds. The world grapples with the impact of global food shortages, 6 million Ethiopian children at risk of malnutrition, the livelihoods of 1.4 billion of the world's poorest farmers who rely on harvesting seeds from one crop or sowing the next season is under threat from biotech companies. And what they did is they gave these guys Terminator seeds and they can't save them. There's no way. They have to buy new seeds every year. Thanks for staying tuned to part of this pre-recorded show I did earlier. But now I'm going to cut to, as of October, I think it's going to be the 4th, but you're going to get to hear this on the 5th. This is going to be 4 or 5 sets of the latest, quote-unquote, science I can find about all the climate and the atmosphere, and I'll see what's going on. It's kind of in between gardening times. But anyway, let's get started. We'll do a few of these, and just remember that you can always go to my site at organicmatters.com. Info to learn more about any of this. I always post three or four of these on that site. But you can also go to natureapproved at Yahoo. But either way, if you want to extend and let me let you know where else you can find this information, by all means, all you need to do is contact me. First, let's talk about some membranes that they've discovered that help to capture carbon dioxide. Drastically reducing the amount of carbon dioxide being emitted into the atmosphere is an essential goal in the effort to mitigate the effects of climate change. And folks, whether you believe we're doing it or not, look around you. There's no doubt there's climate change. While the ultimate solution is to avoid combustion of fossil fuels by the use of cleaner alternatives, the transition's going to take some time, folks. Can't do this overnight. Possibly more time than we may have to really keep things in control. As a result, there is a great deal of effort underway to develop techniques for capturing carbon emitted by fossil fuel combustion and either recycling it or long-term storing it. There are multiple ways to capture carbon emissions, but the ultimate goal is to find a technique that is both inexpensive and scalable. One promising technique involves the use of high-performance membranes, which are filters that can specifically pick out CO2 from a mix of gases, such as those coming out of a typical smokestack from a chimney. Scientists at a Swiss laboratory have now developed a new class of high-performance membranes that exceed the targeted performance for carbon capture by a significant margin. The membranes are based on single-layer graphene with a selective layer thinner than, 20 nanometers, only about 40 atoms thick. The membranes are highly tunable in terms of chemistry, meaning that they can be designed to capture very specific molecules. These membranes are highly permeable, meaning they don't impede gas flow hardly at all, but they're still highly selective. The CO2 N2 separation factor is 22.5, which means in layman terms that 22.5 more nitrogen can get through the membrane than carbon dioxide. The work is just at the laboratory stage at this point, but it is a very promising step towards developing a practical scheme for keeping carbon dioxide from escaping from power plant and factory smokestacks. So let's wish them all the luck. Now let's take a moment and talk about our rapidly rising sea levels all across the world. Coastal cities in the United States are grappling with the need for extensive infrastructure projects to protect against rising seas and worsening storms. The cost of these projects will be enormous, and it is unclear how we're even going to pay for them. Yet nonetheless, this year of above all is an ideal example of what's going to happen as our storms worsen and intensify because of the ever-increasing worldwide temperature and its effects on climate change. The cost of these projects will be enormous, and it's unclear at this time how we're ever going to even pay for them. Boston, for instance, has many neighborhoods in low-lying areas, and it is estimated that $2.4 billion will be needed to protect the city, just that one city, Boston, from flooding. The city abandoned plans to build a harbor barrier that would have cost $6 to $12 billion because it was economically unfeasible. Charleston, South Carolina needs $2 billion to reduce flooding that occurs regularly during high tides without even a big storm. Houston, Texas needs $30 billion to provide protection against a 100-year flood, and they're coming way more often than 100 years now. Hurricane Harvey caused $125 billion in damage in Texas in 2017 alone. How about New York City? New York City is considering a $10 billion storm surge barrier and floodgates to shield parts of that city from ever-rising waters. And the state of Florida faces the greatest exposure to flooding with an estimated $76 billion in cost to address just some of the problems. At the federal level, multiple agencies represent potential funding sources, but none offer the kind of money required to really address the needs.
This places a heavy burden on state and local governments. Various states have passed legislation related to shoreline resiliency and flood abatement, but relatively little funding has actually been approved. Some bond measures have passed, but the totals are small in comparison to the monies actually needed. Educating people about the cost of not doing anything or not doing enough soon enough is essential. As Hurricane Katrina demonstrated, not spending a large amount of money on resilience can result in having to spend a colossal amount of money on recovery. And as a final subject for this portion of the show, let's talk a little bit about 100-year floods. By definition, 100-year floods are intense flooding events that historically tended to happen about every 100 years, duh. But another way a 100-year flood has is 1% chance of happening any given year. Another definition. According to new research published in the journal Nature Communications, rising global temperatures may turn 100-year floods into annual occurrences in many parts of the world, and especially, unfortunately for us here in the United States. The increase in severe coastal flooding events by the end of the century will be a result of rising sea levels and stronger, more frequent tropical storms and hurricanes. And as an aside, this is not directly in what I've put together, but we don't seem to have a grip on that yet, folks. We think, well, no, that's not going to happen again. It is happening more often and far worse. The other thing that seems to happen because of climate change is because the temperature's warmer, the storms don't move as fast. The fronts don't move them as fast, so they sit there. There were parts of Texas, I think it was around Conroe, in this last storm that got 40 inches of rain. The study that I'm quoting was led by researchers at the Princeton University at MIT. Examined flood risk of 171 counties along the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico. Their analysis concluded that 100-year floods will become annual events, especially in New England. That's what's interesting because they're moving north. And in the United States, Southeast, and the Gulf of Mexico, counties could experience such floods as often as every year, up to as seldom as every 25 or 30 years. But certainly it's not going to take 100 years anymore. Previously, most analysis of coastal flooding has looked only at the impact of the sea level rise on the flood risk itself. The new research combined the risk of rising seas with projected changes in coastal storms over the course of the century. Data from the Gulf of Mexico revealed that the effect of stronger storms is comparable with or even more significant than the effect of sea level change for 40% of the counties that were studied. So, neglecting the effects of storm climatology change is likely to significantly underestimate the impact of actual climate change in many places. The hope is that more comprehensive flood risk data can be used to create more effective climate resiliency strategies all the way down to the county level. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back after this with more of Organic Matters.